Six Music.
BBC Radio Six Music Documentaries.
Welcome to The First Time with me, Matt Everett. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential figures in music and take a look at the pivotal first moments that made them who they are today. Today's guest successfully navigated the path from underground rock heroes to mainstream stadium success. As part of the wave of alternative bands that broke through in the early 90s alongside Pearl Jam and Nirvana, the Smashing Pumpkins revolutionised American music. But while their contemporaries eschewed musical excess, the Pumpkins embraced all the influences rock had to offer, be that prog, psychedelia, heavy metal, goth and out-and-out pop, with a virtuosity that often left other bands looking clumsy. Their first three albums, Gish from 93, Siamese Dream from 95, and Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness, are rightly regarded as classics, and they include songs like the one you've just heard today. And despite tragedy, internal fighting, and lineup changes, the band have been responsible for some brilliant work since, and they continue to make records to the present day, the latest being this year's Oceania. And the heart and mind of the Smashing Pumpkins has always been its leader and frontman. Today's guest here on The First Time, Mr. Billy Corgan. In today's show, Billy discusses his formative musical years, the Smashing Pumpkins' tempestuous history, his side projects like the criminally underrated Zwan, and his battles with the way that the US media have perceived him and his work. And I started by asking Billy, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
Well, my father was a musician, so there were always records around, and my earliest memory is of actually playing records on my own. About 2 years old, I had a little toy record player, and that was it.
What kind of things go on the toy record player?
My father loved soul music, people like Al Green and stuff like that, so there's a lot of soul music in the house.
I started to write this song about you, and then I decided that I would write it all about love. Then it appeared to me that you was unhappy. That's for sure, positively. That's what the world is made of. So give me more. Hello, be love. Love is a walk down Main
Music to me was this other almost like religious spiritual thing that seemed to hover around my life. I just remember anytime I came in contact with music, I felt more, which when you're a kid doesn't really make sense to you because you kind of feel how the way you feel. And then when music would be on, I would have more feelings, which was strange to me because why was I having a different experience when music was on? Of course, I didn't intellectualize it at that point. I wasn't capable. All I knew that was music provided me with an experience that only seemed to come from music.
What about the first, like you must have been asked many times, the first record that was yours that you owned, that you bought, that you held in your hands?
Yes. We had a street sale when I was 5 years old, and I was very excited, and I asked my stepmother for some money. She gave me $1. I went down the street, and this guy was selling records, and I remember looking through the records, and I found Meet the Beatles. Didn't know who the Beatles were. I was attracted to the album cover, actually.
Really?
Yeah. And it was 25 cents. That was the first record I ever actually purchased for myself. And I remember putting it on and having this like electric shock go through my body because I could not believe what I was hearing. And I remember really being struck by the sound of their voices. There was something about the sound of their voices that was like, I couldn't understand what was happening. All I knew was it made me feel very, very excited. And I listened to that record incessantly when I was 5 years old.
It's a good starting point though, that. It's a good album, because it's kind of, it's not just early. There's a bit of crossover where they get a little bit more spaced out on that record.
Thank God it wasn't like, you know, Beatles for Sale or something, you know. It was like Meet the Beatles. And I started with, you know, a good one.
What about the first kind of musical obsessions that you had that were kind of maybe more pertinent to your kind of generation?
Well, honestly, I had an uncle who was a drummer, and he had a very progressive record collection, Jethro Tull, Yes, Queen. That was when I was 8 years old. That's when I first came into contact with Black Sabbath.
Which is a big deal for you, obviously.
I think the sound of Black Sabbath, I love Black Sabbath personally. I've always have, and it's been a joy to get to meet them and stuff like that. But the sound of Black Sabbath is something I've just never been able to get out of my mind. It's just something about the combination of the darkness, the size, and the power is something that's influenced pretty much everything I've ever done.
What would be a track that would best sum that up for you?
Well, let's play the track that I first heard. I was 8 years old, and my uncle had Black Sabbath, Master of Reality. I put the album on. I wasn't supposed to play his stereo. It was verboten.
Even better, because then something you're not supposed to do is more exciting.
And I put the needle down, and I heard what I now know is Tony Iommi coughing from a big bong hit or something into Sweetly. So that was my first experience with Black Sabbath.
Surprise!
reunion.
The coming reunion, or the last reunion, or the reunion before that.
The coming reunion with going in with Rick Rubin reunion, I suppose.
I think, like every fan, if the music's really good, I'm all for it. And they're certainly capable. They're certainly capable. Ozzy's, you know, still can sing. Tony can still play. Whether or not they're going to spend that time together, I really hope they do, because it would be amazing to hear very powerful new Black Sabbath. I would be all for it.
Another first. What was the first gig that you can remember going to? Always a big deal in any musician's life is seeing someone on stage, not just hearing it through the speakers.
It's a strange answer for me, because on one hand, my first experiences with music was watching my father rehearse with his band in the basement. And so I had that experience of like loud and the drums. And when my first actual real concert was, I saw Asia, Heat of the Moment.
Nice.
I was 14 years old.
I never meant to be so bad to you. One thing I said that I would never do. A look from you and I would fall from grace. And that would wipe the smile right from my face.
That was my first concert. So we'll default back to my father in the basement. Unfortunately, we don't have that tape, but I'm sure he was playing something, you know, Santana-esque.
Asia, that must have been a big show as well. Big production.
Well, I'll tell you a funny story. I don't know if it means anything, but a couple years ago, Smashing Pumpkins played in Chicago, and we actually played the Opera Hall where I'd seen Asia. And I pointed up to the rafters. I had the worst possible seat at the very, very top. And I said to the, I said, hey, you in this t-shirt. And the person kind of waved. And I said, you know, that's where I sat when I came to my very first concert. So in honor to me and you, I'm going to, and I brought the person down in the front row.
What about your first band that you were responsible for?
Well, my first proper professional band was a band called The Marked, M-A-R-K-E-D. One of the worst names ever. So named because I have a big birthmark on my arm and the drummer had a birthmark on his face. Interesting enough, we played a kind of Bauhaus meets Black Sabbath. So kind of a progenitor version of what became the Smashing Pumpkins. This combination of very alternative 80s UK meets kind of 70s classic rock. We did it very crudely and poorly, and the band broke up after a short time. But that was sort of sowed the seeds for what I later did with the band.
You mentioned Bauhaus and the kind of the UK indie invasion. That's another very, very key thing for you. I mean, The Cure is obviously someone that gets named a lot. Can you remember hearing The Cure for the first time?
Yes, and the strange thing was I had this girlfriend when I was 17, and she was like the cool girl, and she listened to The Cure and Joy Division and all this stuff. And so she made me a tape. And I'd never heard The Cure before. I used to have to take care of I have a disabled brother. I used to have to take care of him a lot. So I spent a lot of time at home practicing. And I was so bored because I had to play guitar by myself. I kind of invented this weird style where I'd played with a lot of open strings. And so it would be more interesting for me to play, almost as if I was playing with another person. So when I first heard The Cure, I was like, oh my God, somebody plays guitar the way I'm already playing guitar. No idea that The Cure was a popular band or even a good band. I just remember thinking, oh my God, this guy's playing guitar like the way I already play guitar.
So it was just a technique thing that you picked up on first?
Yeah, oh absolutely. And then of course I became a big fan and even later got to work with Robert on my solo album. There's an
way. Everybody said, do each you first started playing with James D'Arcy and Jimmy, was it an instantaneous thing where it felt different? Because obviously Jimmy's playing was kind of different to some of your influences. Did it feel special when you first started playing together, is the question?
No.
Brilliant. People normally just go, yeah, there was just something there. It was
no,
just you know,
when I, no, to be honest, when I first realized something special was happening was we grew up in Chicago, which very working class. And so oftentimes, you know, because we were a new band, we would get the terrible slot of playing Santa Wednesday night or something. So, you know, there'd be people at the bar. You're the band that's on. They're not really there to see you. They're talking. And I noticed, because I'd been in other groups, when the four of us were on stage, people paid a different attention. They looked at us differently and they would watch us differently. And I don't know what that was, but I noticed that right away. That's the first time I thought something's happening. Because the music wasn't very good. I didn't think it was very good. But I noticed people paid a different attention to the four of us when we were together. And that proved to be consistent after that. It grew from there. And we learned to figure out what that was and obviously exploit it for Untold Millions.
Your studio work is obviously a core part of who you are as a musician. When you first, that first single, when you first went into the studio with a band, did you have the big ambitions that you would later realize straight away, or did your vision and scope expand as the band went on? Did you always want to be known for these enormously ambitious, beautifully made records?
At the time, if you were lucky, you were going to be as big as Echo and the Bunnymen, play 5,000 people, Cure, play 5,000 people. That was about the top. Depeche Mode, who was in a way more poppy, you could maybe be bigger, but we thought we'll play guitar rock. We're never going to be that pop. So if you were lucky, you were going to make records to the level of Sonic Youth, Dinosaur Jr., Mudhoney, types of bands like this. So the idea was to try to make a visceral record that would be responded to by your generation. Mm. The idea of making a pop record that was going to sell was completely anathema to what we were doing.
Gish, first album, 1991, produced by you and Butch Vig. Legend says it wasn't an easy record to make. Would that be a fair comment to say?
It was slightly difficult, but actually, for the most part, I think it was pretty smooth sailing. Only real politic was the fact that Butch was not crazy about James D'Arcy playing on the record because they weren't very skilled musicians. And so that caused some basic dissension because we were taking trips up to where Butch was, which was 2.5 hours north of Chicago. As the album wore on, James and D'Arcy just stopped coming to the sessions. So Jimmy and I would drive up, stay up there for 4 or 5 days, work, come back down. And we pretty much ended up making the album without them by the end of it. The real drama didn't start till the next album. That's when it got really intense.
How'd you get on with Butch?
Great. Butch is a really easy person to get along with. Very funny, very personable. And just, you know, it's funny because now people say, oh, Butch Vig, and he went on to be successful in Garbage. He obviously made some of the most famous records of my generation. But at the time, Butch was just a small studio owner who'd made a few indie records. So we weren't anybody, he wasn't anybody when we made Gish. In fact, if memory serves me correct, it was $500 a day to work at Smart Studios, and Butch was included in the fee.
Is that it?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think probably charges a bit more than that now. It's still a very ambitious record, that first album, though. You can tell a lot of concentration and love has gone into it. You know, you can hear that you were trying to do something special with it.
The kind of music we were playing at that time, particularly in the Midwest of America, was not really supported by the media. We saw fans responding to it, but we knew media-wise we weren't going to get support. So in a weird kind of way, we thought, well, if we're not going to get supported, we might as well just make the record as weird as we want to make it, because it's probably not going to get good reviews no matter what we do. Because we were playing a very aggressive style, which in the early 90s, to play solos and to be aggressive on the drums and the guitars was a bit like a bourgeois to the indie intelligentsia. Now it's kind of laughable because those things mean absolutely nothing now. But at the time, they were actually a big deal.
As that started, as the kind of music that you were making headed towards more and more popularity, inevitably things get grouped together. People love to put things in pigeonholes. Did you resent kind of being put in the same boxes as a Pearl Jam, as a Jane's Addiction, as a Nirvana? Or didn't that really bother you? Did you see yourselves as separate regardless of what the media said?
Oh, it drove me insane.
Really?
It drove me absolutely insane.
Why? Is it the simplification of art, I suppose?
We all go through this experience in life. I don't know what the version of is in the UK, but in America we call it high school, right? Hmm. It's around high school that you start to realize, like, oh, the girl that I like likes the quarterback because he's handsome and dumb, so my intelligence means nothing. Oh. The weird girl in class who everybody kind of makes fun of thinks I'm cute because I'm weird looking, but I want the cheerleader to like me. You start to figure out who you are in the social world. Well, the same thing happens in music. You start off with an idea, which generally speaking comes from your own particular passions. And then as you enter into the world, you start to find out, like, oh, your voice is too weird. Your band will never be successful. Your name's too stupid. Your band is never going to be successful. Oh, you're from Chicago. Oh, nobody likes Chicago. You'll never be successful. You start to get all these things put on you that don't have anything to do with whether or not you're good. Mm. And this still happens. People make decisions, very snap decisions, on the way somebody looks, you know, the way somebody sounds. Even to this point, the things I say in an interview will overly color the way people hear my music. So as we went along, we saw ourselves being dumbed down.
Okay.
There was a sort of mythology in the early 90s, which went something like this. The genius wakes up when rolls out of bed and writes a hit song, and he's so oblivious to it. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
Of course, the people who were actually doing the music were very intelligent and in many ways calculating in their symbolism, as all good artists can be and should be, in a way. John Lennon was no different in his brilliance, you know, and so were the people of my generation. So I was a person who was willing to engage more overtly in the wires of the process. The more I engaged and was honest about what I was doing, the more I was almost kind of put down for being overly calculating, overly ambitious. The records were overproduced. We were trying too hard. You know, I would read quotes like, he has an insufferable intensity. And then I would read other articles on other bands, and it was all about how much fun they were. You know, how they went to the pub and they had a good time. And see, this is why their music is great, because they don't care about any of this stuff. And it was all a show. So this drove me insane to the point where I was like, I thought, well, if I'm not going to get it handed to me like I see it handed to other people, I'm going to have to take it. And I'm just going to have a band that's just better, meaner, faster, crazier, really.
Serve you with a smile. Cut you like you want me to. Cut that little child. Saddle me in such a part of you. Ooh, leaves burn. Ooh, leaves burn.
That was the Smashing Pumpkins with Disarm from their 1994 album Siamese Dream. And you're listening to the first time here on Six Music with me, Matt Everett, and my guest from the Smashing Pumpkins, Billy Corgan.
Six Music. Six.
Welcome back to the first time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest this week. From probably the most ambitious band in US alternative rock, the Smashing Pumpkins, it's Billy Corgan. And illustrating how the Smashing Pumpkins sounded at the peak of their powers, that was Cherub Rock, the first single from their second album, 1993's Siamese Dream.
This is the record that really hurled you headfirst into the mainstream. How much of it was born out of the frustrations that you were explaining and being influenced by the culture from which you are being pushed into?
This is a bit psychological. The Smashing Pumpkins' reaction as a unit to pressure was to embrace it and then destroy it. So, for example, the first song in Siamese Dream is Cherub Rock. 5-minute song, total prog rock. It opens with a riff lifted right off of the Canadian rock band Rush. It goes into some massive, you know, thing, and the first lines are all about how indie rock is completely false.
That's a statement of intent straight away, isn't it, really?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, right? You know, first, the first line's down. Freak out and give in, doesn't matter what you believe in. That's the first line of the record. It's basically saying, it doesn't matter what we do, you're going to change us into something we're not. And that became part of the Smashing Pumpkins' operating ethos. They're not going to let us be who we are. They're not going to embrace who we actually are. So we're going to become almost larger than life who we are. If you think we're dramatic, we're going to be overly dramatic. If you think our concerts is long, wait till we really play a long concert. We overreacted, but we did it on purpose. We would be written about as if we were too stupid to realize why we were being annoying or how we were being annoying. And we were like, no, we actually realize we're being annoying. We're doing it on purpose. Don't you get the joke?
I suppose it's one way of dealing with being in that world, I suppose.
Listen, when you're a kid and you don't have any power, what do? You say, I'm not going to eat my broccoli. Mm. What was our way of not eating our broccoli? You're not going to tell us how long our songs should be. You're not going to tell us how many songs we should play in our concerts. If we want to play for 3.5 hours, that's what we're going to do. We used to end our concerts with a 45-minute song, and half the audience would leave. You know, any manager will tell you, look, when people leave before the concert's over, they don't buy T-shirts. They leave kind of like frustrated because obviously they didn't. They're leaving like, I've had enough of this. You're hurting yourself, right? You know, you're consciously saying, we don't care if half the audience leaves. I mean, we were all smart people. We just didn't care at the level that people wanted us to care at, because we cared for something else, which is we're going to be ourselves no matter what you say. Siamese Dream was very informed by, okay, you think we're this? Like, people would say about Gish, oh, you guys are kind of classic rock. I mean, if you could have read the reviews of Gish, it was like, oh, they sound like the Black Crows. Oh, they really sound like REM. Oh, they sound like, 60s bands. Now you listen, the record doesn't sound like that at all, right? So we're like, oh, you think we're classic rock? We'll give you classic rock. And then we made an album of ELO, Boston, Electric Light Orchestra. You know, basically, we wanted to shove it up everybody's arse. You know, like, we were brilliantly dumbing ourselves down to almost play a joke on everybody. And people actually began to believe we were that dumb, which became even more comical. And we fed into it even more. And it started this thing that's just never stopped. I used to say to people, like, I do interviews and they say, you know, you're very serious and you're very, you know, you're very intense. And I go, I'm in a band called the Smashing Pumpkins. I'm in a band with a joke name. Hello, it's on the calling card. It's all a joke.
Enchanted in the rapture of his sentimental sway, but underneath the wheels lie the skulls of every cog, the fickle fascination of an everlasting god. You know I'm not.
When did you think that your time with the Smashing Pumpkins, as was then, was over? Was there a point when you first thought, this road has come to an end?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's hard to say because when I should have left, I didn't. And then it's one of those things like once you stay, it's like there's no easy exit. If I had my life to do over again, I would have left the band immediately after Jonathan Melvoin died, who was our touring keyboardist, overdosed on heroin when Jimmy Chamberlain, our drummer, right before we were playing two sold-out Madison Square Garden shows. I mean, it can't be any more Hollywood tragic. Mm. You know, we're on the eve of this crowning achievement in American life. To play Madison Square Garden is a big deal.
Absolutely.
And here we have two sold-out shows, and the night before we're supposed to play these two sold-out shows, our drummer and our touring keyboardist overdose. Jimmy survives, Jonathan dies. It becomes a huge thing in the media, and they're debating it on Nightline and, you know, drugs and music, and suddenly we're in the middle of a social argument and our drummer leaves. That's when I should have taken myself out of the picture. It was completely dysfunctional. I was sober, you know, and I'm on TV talking about drugs. I mean, it was a total joke. That should have been my, you know what, this drama is over and I'm going to go. I was still imbued with my emotional and musical power at that point. Instead, I stayed for another 4 years and allowed the situation to completely drain every ounce of blood out of my body, out of some sort of warped concept of loyalty. And I guess in unconsciously, I hoped that at some point my band would return. And there was a brief moment in 1999 where the four of us actually got back in a room and worked for a short amount of time and did brilliant work in such a short amount of time that it was still there. It was still in the bones, but not meant to be. So I would say that's when I should have left, but I just didn't listen to myself.
In the wake of you leaving, I have to ask you about Bowie. You've made no secret of your love for Bowie. You played with him.
Mm. At Madison Square Garden.
When did you first meet Bowie? It's a lovely question to ask someone, isn't it?
I think I first met him on a kind of a festival situation where we were both playing on, or maybe it was a TV show. I honestly don't remember. I know that sounds terrible, but I'm lucky enough that
I'd remember when I first met David Bowie.
No, I mean, honestly, it sounds terrible, but the reason I don't remember when I first met David Bowie was because I've been lucky enough to meet David, you know, 10, 15 times. And enough to where, you know, you're no longer like in awe that you're talking to David Bowie, but you're talking to David and he's a nice person and you can have a conversation and not turn into fanboy. David's a lovely guy. Always had nice contact with him. He's always been very, very gracious and very, very kind to me. Really meant a lot because to me, he's such a special artist, such a unique artist, so influential, such a gifted singer, really could have been a Frank Sinatra type singer, easy, no doubt about it. The fact that he chose to be this avant-garde artist really says a lot about him as a person. I have nothing but great things to say about him. I still listen to his music all the time. I'm still inspired by him. His ideas still mean something to me.
If we're going to play a Bowie track, what Bowie track should we play?
I'm partial to Moon Age Daydream. I always think that's such a brilliant track for a variety of reasons. One, he's in incredible vocal form. Two, Mick Ronson plays incredible guitar on this track. The band is incredible. The Spiders from Mars, what an incredible band. After this album, you know, Ziggy Stardust, David goes on and becomes a much bigger star, and the classic thing happens, kind of starts to get separated from his band and goes on a different path, and obviously play with lots of other musicians. But at the end of the day, I'm a band guy, and I think David with the band that he loved and loved them, such powerful work.
I'm an alligator. Coming for you. I'm the space invader. I'll be a rock and rolling bitch for you. Keep your mouth shut. Just smoke it like a big monkey bird. And I'm busting up my brain for the world.
to ask you about Zwan, because I just love that record, man. Oh, I just really, you. I mean...
Well, you'll be happy to know as a Zwan fan that there are 65 unreleased tracks.
Lyric, come with me. Honestly, that's just some great songwriting.
Oh, thank you.
Can I go there? Okay, can you give me
yeah,
what happened there, man? It was a great album. It's a great, really strong record.
Zwan in a nutshell.
Yeah, nutshell, there we go.
Okay. There was a myth that grew in the Smashing Pumpkins between Jimmy and I that if we played with better musicians, better things would happen, because we'd play with James and Darcy, who were smart people but not great musicians. Okay. So Zwan was like, right, we're going to get great musicians. So we reached into the indie ranks for three really good indie musicians. David Pa, who had made influential records with Slint, Matt, who had worked with Skunk and Chavez, and Paz, who'd been on tour with Perfect Circle, but it could come from indie music. And we thought, great, three great musicians. We're great musicians. We're all going to get in a room. You can't account for character. You can't account for character. And at the end of the day, the other three Zwan members cared more about what the people in New York and LA thought of them being in a big band than they cared about their band. And at the end of the day, that just blew the band apart.
Tell me some of that stuff's going to get heard one day.
Oh, yeah. No, the good news is that I own all the stuff, and it's a long explanation, but in 2 years, I get all the rights back to Zwan. So hopefully in sequence, once all the Pumpkin reissues clear, then we'll be able to do a full Zwan box set. There's 65 unreleased songs.
Awesome. So
a lot of great work. We did a lot of really good work in a short amount of time because everyone was a good musician. But I don't look back fondly on that time at all. It's almost like the way I like to explain it is when you have a great relationship and you try to recreate it and you end up with a way worse girlfriend.
Alone, a sudden home, a wooden gate, I
Let's look forward to the Pumpkins, as are now, and as are Tear Garden in Kaleidoscope. This is, can you explain this epic project to people? Because kind of obviously words does have a tendency to fly around these days.
Well, 2 years ago we started releasing one song at a time for free. The idea was to release 44 songs. I think to this point we've released about 10. We've done it. It's actually done really well in America with connecting with fans. But for some reason in Europe, maybe because I didn't do a lot of interviews, people don't really know about the project. So we decided now to make a conventional album within the Tear Garden project, which is Oceana. We've just finished it. It's probably going to come out in March. And then we'll be able to put it out with a sort of traditional label situation in Europe and hopefully get some of the European fans back on point, because I think they just don't even know we're out there releasing music.
But the plan is to do this huge, how many tracks? 44 song, I believe somebody said.
I don't know. Honestly, I just picked a number that would make me work.
Really?
44 sounded about right. You know, I mean, I know that sounds like a lot, but for example, on the Melancholy era, we released 28 songs on Melancholy and 28 B-sides, so 56 Melancholy tracks. So 44 is really not that many when you get down to it.
And the last question we ask everyone on this show, to pick the last song.
Well, I would like to play a song by The Cure, because The Cure is one of the greatest UK bands ever. And believe it or not, I used to have a Robert Smith haircut. Maybe that's why all my hair is gone now, but... let's see, what can I play? Primary by The Cure.
Why that song?
I just love The Cure. I think everything Robert does is imbued with a sort of special Robertness. And I just love him as a person. I just think he's such a great artist. And I think The Cure as a band, their influence and their legacy is only going to grow. I'm very happy to see them out playing always.
Thank you very much for your time. It's good to speak to you.
Great, thank you.
This is Six Music. And in the night, it was a drunken stutter. Started as a next to nothing conversation. And then he's tearing me out. taking me apart at my friend's house. I was uncomfortable, I was hurt, still with blue innocence in his eyes. I felt my reasoning was harsh. With every stab wound and exhale, I promised myself that I would never lose my youthful fears. If grown up men, I'm scarred with cruel intentions. I thought of another the whole time. Romance is dead and done, and it hits between the eyes on this side. The grass is dead and barren, and it hurts between my thighs on this side. I could begin to open up every
is BBC Radio.
Six music.
Right now, it's Chris Hawkins.
Consequences, altered cases, broken noses, altered faces, my ego altered, altered egos, wherever I go, so does me go. Walk through the fields where the flowers are growing. Carve out your names on the first tree you see. There are 22 catches when you strike your matches.